Imagine sitting in a room with a therapist, just pouring your heart out about a trauma that has haunted you for decades.
Right, an incredibly vulnerable moment.
Exactly. And you finish speaking, your heart is pounding, and you wait for the expert to give you the answer, but the therapist refuses to give you a single piece of advice.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. They offer no clinical diagnosis, no opinions, no comforting wisdom, and absolutely no interpretation of what you just said.
Wow.
I mean, it sounds like a terrible therapy session,
It
right?
sounds completely counterintuitive to what we expect.
It really does. Yet this exact method, relying entirely on the client's own subconscious metaphors, has been shown to cure severe, decades-old trauma in like a matter of minutes.
Which is just staggering to think about.
It is. So today we're doing a deep dive into the clinical writings of a therapist named Clint Matheny, and he outlines this psychological framework called clean language.
Yes, a really groundbreaking approach.
Our mission today for you, the listener, is to unpack exactly what this framework is, you know, the mechanics of how it rewires the brain, and why it might fundamentally alter the way you approach, well, pretty much every single conversation you have from here on out.
What's fascinating here is the radical shift in the power dynamic between two people talking. I mean, clean language completely strips away the ego of the listener.
Right, because usually the therapist is seen as the expert.
Exactly. In a normal clinical setting, the therapist is almost like the hero swooping in with all the answers. But instead, this framework is about accessing the subconscious and exploring personal narratives in a strictly non-judgmental, profoundly safe space.
So they aren't fixing anything directly.
No, not at all. The practitioner simply builds the scaffolding, allowing the client's own mind to find its deeply embedded solutions.
Okay, let's unpack this because the core premise challenges literally everything we think we know about being helpful.
It really does. It flips it on its head.
Yeah. And to understand how a conversation without advice can possibly heal someone, we actually have to look at the exact historical problem this method was invented to solve.
Right, going back to the roots of the issue.
Exactly. If we go back roughly 40 years, the widely accepted method for treating severe trauma was something called desensitization or exposure therapy.
And the prevailing logic at the time was almost brute force in its approach. I mean, the belief was that you needed to force clients to talk through their horrific experiences over and over again.
Literal details.
Yes, in explicit, literal detail.
Yeah.
The idea was that if you expose the patient to the terrible memory enough times, eventually, well, the memory will lose its emotional charge. It'll just become a boring story.
But biologically speaking, the human nervous system just doesn't work like that at all.
It absolutely doesn't. And the damage being done by this was significant.
Yeah, the sources mention an innovator who noticed this, right?
Yes, a New Zealand therapist named David Grove. He was observing these desensitization sessions and realized they weren't curing people. In fact, in many cases, they were actively re-traumatizing them.
Oh, wow. Actively making it worse.
Exactly. Because when you force a severely traumatized person to recount the literal details of an event, their brain's veer centered the amygdala well. It doesn't know the difference between the memory and the present moment.
Right, the amygdala doesn't have a clock.
Precisely. So their body dumps the exact same cortisol and adrenaline into their bloodstream as when the event actually happened. You aren't desensitizing them, you're basically putting their nervous system right back into a state of sheer panic.
Yeah, it's like pouring gasoline on a fire and hoping it eventually just burns itself out.
That's a great way to put it. It's incredibly destructive.
But Grove noticed something incredibly subtle about the way clients naturally wanted to speak when they were in distress, didn't he?
Yes, and that observation became his eureka moment. He noticed that clients, when left to their own devices without the therapist interrupting, spontaneously described their symptoms using metaphors.
Like they wouldn't use clinical jargon.
Right, they wouldn't say, "I am experiencing a severe stress response." They would say something like, "It feels like I have a ton of bricks crushing my chest," or "I'm trapped in a dark, freezing box."
So they naturally leaned into imagery.
Exactly. And Grove found that if he ignored the literal details of the trauma and instead explored the architecture of those metaphors, the psychological disorders were actually alleviated.
You know, reading through Grove's findings, a specific analogy popped into my head.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
Well, think about traditional therapy, like a poorly led witness interrogation.
Okay, I can see where you're going with this.
Yeah, so if a detective sits down with a vulnerable witness and starts using their own vocabulary, you know, asking leading questions or suggesting scenarios, they accidentally plant false memories.
Right, they lead the witness.
Exactly. They contaminate the witness's original story. The witness might even start agreeing with the detective just to appease them, and the truth of the actual experience gets completely overwritten.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of psychology, Grove realized therapists, even with the best intentions, were acting exactly like those bad detectives.
By leading the client.
Exactly. By introducing their own clinical vocabulary, their own ideas, or their own values, they were contaminating the client's fragile inner world.
Meaning, if a client says they feel a heaviness, and the therapist says, oh, it sounds like you have unresolved anger, that right there is a contamination.
A massive one. Because the moment the therapist labels it anger, they force the client to view their own subconscious through the therapist's lens.
Even if that wasn't what it was at all.
Right. Maybe to the client, that heaviness felt like a tight knot of wet ropes. By calling it anger, the therapist had just trampled all over the client's reality.
So they completely hijacked the metaphor.
They did. To solve this, to really honor the client's experience without contaminating it, Grove developed a highly disciplined linguistic tool set.
This is the actual clean language part.
Yes. He figured out a way to repeat the client's exact words back to them, carrying the absolute minimum amount of influence. That was the birth of clean language.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the way Matheny describes conducting a session made me think of a second analogy for you.
Let's hear it.
So imagine a high-tech clean room. The kind used for manufacturing computer microchips.
Oh, like the ones where they have to wear the special suits?
Exactly. These rooms are completely sealed off. The engineers wear those giant white hazmat suits. They go through airlocks.
Because the environment has to be perfectly controlled.
Right. Why? Because if you bring even a single speck of your own dust from the outside world into that room, the microchip is completely ruined. It's simply too delicate.
That's a brilliant visual.
Yeah. And in this framework, the microchip is the client's fragile metaphor. And the dust. The dust is your vocabulary, your judgments, your advice, your need to fix the problem.
Everything you bring from the outside.
Right. If you bring your dust into the conversation, the metaphor breaks.
I love that visual. And it perfectly explains the necessity of the hazmat suit, which in this case is the specific set of clean language questions Grove developed.
Right. The tools to keep the room clean.
Exactly. The source material outlines the fundamental mechanics. First, you listen with extreme attention. Second, you keep your opinions and interpretations entirely to yourself.
Which is incredibly hard to do.
Very hard. Third, you ask specifically worded questions about the person's metaphors. And fourth, you listen and repeat the cycle.
But the syntax of these questions, that is what really blew my mind. When you first read the 9 basic questions Matheny lists, they sound almost robotic.
They do sound strange to our modern ears, definitely.
Yeah, very unnatural at first glance.
For example, a core starting question is simply, and what would you like to have happen?
Just very neutral.
Completely neutral. And if the client mentions a metaphor, like say, a heavyweight, you wouldn't ask how it got there. You would ask, and what kind of heavyweight is that heavyweight?
Or they might ask, and that heavyweight is like, what?
Yes. Or, and is there anything else about that heavyweight?
You know, the first thing that jumps out to me is the glaring absence of the word why.
That's a very keen observation.
There is no, why do you have a heavyweight? Or why does that make you sad? It's just entirely missing from the toolkit.
And the omission of why is entirely intentional. It points to the underlying mechanism of how this whole thing works.
How so?
Well, asking why forces a client into their analytical brain, the neocortex. It forces them to intellectualize their trauma and justify their feelings to you, the external observer.
So they're analyzing the feeling instead of just feeling it.
Exactly. Clean language targets the subconscious emotional centers of the brain. These bizarrely simple questions are incredibly powerful because they force the speaker to look inward.
They keep them grounded in the imagery.
Right. They keep the client safely inside the metaphor, exploring the physical geography of their own subconscious.
Because, the metaphor isn't just a figure of speech. It is the actual literal way the brain has stored the sensory data of the trauma.
That is the crucial mechanism right there. The brain uses metaphor to package complex, overwhelming sensory information.
So it's like a container.
Yes. Right. And when you ask, and what kind of heavyweight is that? You're asking the brain to examine its own packaging.
Oh, wow. That makes so much sense.
As the client answers, observing the size, shape, and location of the metaphorical weight, the neural pathways associated with that trauma are activated, but without the panic. They are observing it, not reliving it.
Which brings us to a case study in the text that genuinely stopped me in my tracks.
The Nancy case.
Yes. It's one thing to talk about examining the packaging of trauma in theory, but seeing Clint Matheny apply this in 1994 to a woman named Nancy is staggering. We are talking about an incredibly severe case of hypervigilance.
It really is a profound demonstration of the modality in action. Nancy had been experiencing intense daily fear for over 20 years.
20 years, that's a lifetime.
And the root of her trauma was unimaginably difficult. When she was a young woman, her father had committed suicide by shooting himself with a shotgun in an adjoining room while she was in the house.
God. The sheer acoustic shock of that combined with the emotional devastation. I mean, you can't even fathom the impact on her nervous system.
Her nervous system essentially never reset. For two decades, she lived with severe, physically debilitating PTSD symptoms.
The sources mentioned her sleep habits, right?
Yes. Her hypervigilance was so extreme that she had to sleep facing a doorway every single night.
And at work, it was just as bad.
At her workplace, she literally made hospital security check under her car every single day before she felt safe enough to get into it.
20 years of that level of daily exhaustion-inducing fear. And then she sits down with Matheny in 1994. How does the session actually play out?
Matheny uses clean language to explore the physical sensation of her fear. He doesn't ask her to recount the day of the suicide.
So no desensitization?
None. Instead, he asks her about the present feeling. When asked what the fear is like, a client in Nancy's position might describe it as a dark shadow looming over her shoulder or a vibrating alarm bell in her chest.
Something visceral like that.
Right. And by asking those clean questions, and is there anything else about that shadow, or, and where is that shadow? Matheny guides her subconscious to explore the construct of the fear.
And as she explores the metaphor, it begins to physically shift.
It reconsolidates. Once the subconscious is allowed to safely observe the metaphor without judgment or advice from the therapist, the brain realizes it has the power to change the imagery.
So it mutates.
Yes. The shadow might shrink. The alarm bell might dissolve. According to Matheny's clinical records, the actual therapy session lasted for less than 30 minutes.
And the intervention itself, like the time it took for her metaphor to shift and release the trauma.
Less than 10 minutes.
That's just wild.
Within that time frame, she was effectively cured of a hypervigilance that had defined her life for 20 years. The source explicitly notes a follow-up interview done weeks later to confirm the results held. And they did.
Okay, I have to jump in here and push back on behalf of anyone listening right now.
I figured you might.
Yeah, I mean, a 10-minute conversation to undo 20 years of deeply ingrained, physically altering trauma sounds like snake oil. It sounds impossible.
It does sound too good to be true.
Right. We're supposed to believe that just asking about the shape of a metaphorical shadow acts as a miracle cure. There has to be a catch to this.
It is entirely fair to be skeptical. The claim is monumental. But the source material addresses this head on, and you are right to suspect a limitation.
So there is a catch.
Yes. This is not a magic wand that works unilaterally on every single human brain, regardless of circumstance. There is a major clinical hurdle that both David Grove and Clint Matheny encountered, and it has to do with biology.
Wait, if this therapy relies entirely on the client being able to viscerally feel and explore their subconscious metaphor, what happens if their feelings are chemically suppressed?
You're right on the money.
Does this even work on someone taking heavy psychiatric medication?
You've hit the exact limitation they discovered. They found highly mixed results, and often absolutely no results, with clients who were currently taking psychotherapeutic medications.
Do they specify which ones?
The text specifically lists benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, and barbiturates.
Because those drugs are literally designed to blunt the nervous system.
Precisely. Those medications chemically suppress the somatic markers, meaning the physical sensations of emotion in the body, to keep a patient stable.
So they can't feel the metaphor physically.
Exactly. As Matheny writes, quoting directly from the source, you can't heal what you can't feel.
Wow. You can't heal what you can't feel.
If a medication is chemically anesthetizing the emotional response, the patient cannot physically access the feeling required to move through the clean language process. The metaphor remains frozen because the underlying emotion is walled off by the medication.
That is a heavy realization, but it makes complete logical sense within the framework of memory reconsolidation.
It really does.
The raw material of the healing isn't the therapist's advice. The raw material is the feeling itself. And if you numb the raw material, the machinery just can't run.
Exactly. The client must be able to fully inhabit the physical and emotional space of their inner world for that metaphorical shift to occur.
So we have this incredibly potent tool for clinical trauma, provided the client can fully access their feelings.
Right.
But reading through these sources, the implications started bleeding into my normal life, like everyday stuff.
How so?
Well, if introducing dust ruins a trauma metaphor, I must be ruining my friends and coworkers' problem-solving metaphors every single day by giving them my unsolicited advice.
Oh, absolutely. And that realization is driving a massive expansion of this framework. Clean language is rapidly moving far beyond clinical trauma work.
Into corporate spaces and things like that.
Exactly. The source material highlights that interviewers, executive coaches, and business consultants are increasingly adopting these exact questions to revolutionize their communication skills.
Because the dynamic is basically the same. Whether it's trauma or a business bottleneck, you want the person to uncover their own solution.
Yes. You want them to have the agency.
Imagine a team member comes into your office and says, you know, we've hit a brick wall on this project. I'm drowning. The immediate instinct, what coaches sometimes call the advice monster, is to jump in and say, okay, let's delegate your tasks. Let's smash through that wall.
Right. You want to be the hero again. But the moment you say, let's smash the wall, you've introduced your dust.
You've contaminated their problem.
You've taken the responsibility and the agency completely away from them. Using a clean language model, a manager would instead ask, and what kind of brick wall is that brick wall? Or, and what would you like to have happen?
Just reflecting it back.
Yes. This allows the employee to explore their own perception of the problem. Maybe their metaphor shifts and they realize the wall has a door in it, or they can just walk around it. They take full responsibility for reaching their own desired outcomes.
And the demand for this kind of communication is surging right now.
It really is.
The text mentions online Zoom classes are widely available now from practitioners like Sharon Small and Gina Campbell.
Right. The training is getting very accessible.
And veterans in the field like James Lawley and Penny Tompkins have brought this training to thousands worldwide. There's even a best-selling book mentioned in the text by Tamsin Hartley called The Listening Space. It is turning into a genuine movement.
This raises an important question about our default behaviors.
Oh, for sure.
How much of our daily communication is actually just us projecting our own ideas, our own contaminants onto others?
Probably most of it, if we're being honest.
Right. When a partner or a friend comes to us in pain or frustration, are we truly listening to the unique architecture of their inner world? Or are we just waiting for our turn to speak so we can cover their delicate microchip in our own dust?
I want to challenge you, the listener, with that exact thought. Think about how incredibly difficult it is to not give advice.
It's harder than it sounds.
It is. Try an experiment today. Imagine trying to get through just one single conversation at work or at home using only clean language questions.
Just one conversation.
Yeah. Completely withhold your opinions, your vocabulary, and your desire to, quote unquote, fix the person in front of you.
Mm.
Just ask, and what would you like to have happen? And actually listen to the answer without judging it. I guarantee it will be one of the hardest communication exercises you do all week.
It requires an immense amount of discipline to get out of the way. But when you do, you allow people the dignity of their own experience.
So what does this all mean? We've covered some truly fascinating terrain today.
We really have.
We explored the neurological flaw of forcing traumatized patients to relive their pain through literal retelling. We unpacked David Grove's brilliant discovery that the brain stores trauma in metaphors, and that those metaphors can be safely dismantled without the therapist ever giving advice.
A total paradigm shift.
Absolutely. We saw Clint Matheny use this clean room technique to help Nancy release 20 years of severe hypervigilance in a matter of minutes. And finally, we looked at how this clinical tool is evolving into a daily communication practice for coaches, leaders, and just everyday relationships.
It is a profound rethinking of how we relate to one another. And to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day.
Yeah.
If clean language teaches us anything, it's that our subconscious metaphors literally shape our reality, our physical stress responses, and our ability to heal. So what are the subtle everyday metaphors you're using to describe your own life right now?
That's a great question.
When you talk about your job, your relationships, your daily stresses, what is the imagery you default to? And more importantly, if you take a step back and examine those metaphors, are they holding you back or are they setting you free?
That is a lot to chew on, and maybe a really good reason to pay very close attention to the words we use today. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take care of yourselves, and we'll catch you next time.